So I want to tell you what this talk is about from the beginning, because you might not like it. So it's good that you know, so you can prepare yourself, because you know, maybe you'll suspect that something bad is happening here. So if I tell you up front what is happening, then at least the experience will be less unpleasant. So I'm interested in this problem to find a theory of quantum gravity. So we have these two theories that we're trying to in some way reconcile. We have general relativity, which is a kind of beautiful, pristine theory. And then we have quantum theory, which has problems, such as the measurement problem, various interpretational problems. Now, what people usually try to do is solve the problems of quantum theory. And then, you know, once you've solved, you know, if you're taking a foundational approach, once you've solved the problems of quantum theory, then maybe you have some chance of doing something. But I think that's the wrong approach. So what I'm going to do and try and do instead is corrupt general relativity. At least then if you bring general relativity down to the level of quantum theory, maybe you can then sort of have some kind of marriage of equals. So you might say that one's interested in the Copenhagen interpretation of general relativity. And if those words don't make Einstein turning his grave, I don't know what will. So what I'm actually going to do is I'm going to present work which is towards an operational framework which were rich enough to accommodate both quantum theory and general relativity, and ultimately, hopefully, a theory of quantum gravity. Of course, I'm not yet there yet. The framework I have will accommodate quantum theory, though not general relativity. So actually, what I'm interested in is probabilistic general relativity. By that, I mean the theory you get when you take general relativity, that you allow yourself probabilistic ignorance of the values of measured quantities. So that's, at some level, ought to be a well-defined theory, although I don't think anyone's actually written it down yet. I suspect that to do that, you have to go to an operational framework, but I don't know that. So there's been a lot of literature recently about general probabilistic theories, sort of convex cones approach and so on. And usually people formulate this in a kind of operational context. So you have various operations, you have inputs, outputs, outcomes, and so on, knobs and settings. So you could say there's a sense in which operational structures form a foundation for general probabilistic theories. So that's the attitude I want to take. So you've got some sort of operational structure, and then you've got probabilistic theories which sit on top of that. Now, my contention is that researchers into general probabilistic theories usually take a fairly naive approach to this operational structure. Just a simple picture of, you know, preparation, transformation, measurement. Or if they're trying to be a bit more sophisticated, you'll have things like this. We have various preparations in series, various transformations, and various measurements. And in this picture, there's a very ingrained notion of time, so that at any given time, you have various operations happening in parallel. Even so far as this kind of approach goes, I think one can do a bit better. Ultimately, I want to go beyond even this. But let me just talk about how one can be a bit more serious. So first of all, our basic building block is the operation. Particular instances of operation might constitute a measurement, a transformation, or a preparation. So preparation, for example, would be where you have no inputs. So an operation has some knob settings, These are various knobs that you may have that you can adjust to vary the effects of the operation. It'll have some outcomes, so you may have some flashing lights or meters that you can read off and write down the results, measurements of the sort of outcomes of this operation. And then we have various inputs and outputs that you might imagine. These are where you send, you know, electrons or photons or something into the operation here, and then come out here. The number of inputs and outputs don't have to be the same, or even of the same type in general. And then also we introduce this notion of having open or closed inputs and outputs. We imagine that there's some way of closing an input or closing an output. So closing an output, for example, would just really consist of putting a block there so that the electron is stopped. Then we have wires, and you can use wires to connect up these operations to make a circuit. So a circuit is something that has no open inputs or outputs left over. You can see that here's an example of a circuit. The wires, one should be careful about what they mean. The wires show how the inputs and outputs are connected up. It's a kind of IKEA idea. If you look at, if you buy a piece of IKEA furniture and you open the box and you get this little diagram telling you how to put the piece of furniture together, it has a kind of exploded picture of the furniture, of the piece of furniture, with little lines showing you how to connect the different pieces. So the lines don't actually exist when you have the assembled piece of furniture, but they tell you how it's constructed. And the wires form the same function in this case. They're not actually there as such. If you actually have a wire, that itself constitutes an operation because it may have an effect on things that pass along it. Oh, and incidentally, because I have this sort of input-output interpretation of this node at the bottom and at the top, so I don't want to have closed loops. So there is a kind of background time implicit in this. So what one can do with this framework, and I'm not going to go through this in any great detail, is one can start to set up various concepts that are necessary for setting up general probabilistic theories. So for example, here's a useful notion, a synchronous set of wires. So I can identify a set of wires and say they're synchronous if there's no way of going from one wire in the set to another wire in the set by going forward along these wires. So this is not a synchronous set because I can get from this wire to this wire by going forward, but this one is. That's a useful notion. You can say that systems are associated with synchronous sets of wires. If you do that, then you have basically a operational definition of what you mean by system. Because don't forget, these wires are entirely operational things. They just tell you how the experiment is put together. So so if you say that systems are associated with synchronous sets of wires, then you have an operational notion of what you mean by system, which answers one of the points in the discussion yesterday that Andreas brought up. System doesn't have to be a fundamental notion. But you can also have notions like composite system. So for example, you can have two synchronous sets of wires where the union itself is also a synchronous set of wires. So for example, this set, and then I can have another set here consisting of just this wire. And then the union of those two sets is also a synchronous set. So that, so you could think of that as having a, you know, having one system here, another system here, which form a composite system. So you can set up these general notions if you want. Now here's a useful definition that if we have this, then we can really make progress in setting up the sorts of operational structures we see in quantum theory. So I define, and what's important here is now we're introducing probabilities into the picture. Um, So this is the notion of a closable set of operations. So imagine we have a set of operations. You know, a laboratory, for example, will have various operations that are available. Now, imagine we have a closable set. What that means is that it has these two properties. First of all, the probability associated with any given circuit where you specify the knob settings and the outcomes is well defined. What I mean by that is the probability associated with that circuit doesn't depend on what happens with some other operations elsewhere that aren't part of the circuit. You can't vary knob settings elsewhere, for example, and change the probability. And then secondly, we imagine that this probability is unchanged when we do the following. So we take some circuit here, and now we open these outputs and add some extra circuitry on. We imagine that the probability associated with this bit of circuitry over here, ignoring what outcomes you have up here, is the same in the case where you add this on as when you didn't. That's sort of saying that there's no influence from the future. So your set of operations are in some sense closed from the future. So if we have these properties, I'll say that that's a closable set of operations. So instances of sets of operations that aren't closable would be, for example, if you have some quantum gate, which you're treating as a one-bit quantum gate, but it's actually a two or two-qubit quantum gate. So you're not aware of some other input into that quantum gate. What that means is, so you're not drawing wires corresponding to the other input in your diagrams because you don't know about it. So what that would mean is that someone who was was aware of that could exploit it and send qubits into it in order to make the probabilities depend on what they did. So that the probabilities would depend on some extra circuitry elsewhere. Yeah.
So you're speaking of outputs and of outcomes.
Yeah.
The so the outputs are supposed to be closed, but you're still speaking of outcomes at the same time. What are the outcomes?
So outcomes are lights flashing, meter readings that you might write down because of this data. Whereas inputs and outputs are things that you might want in a quantum context. For example, you would send electrons or qubits. So they're quite different concepts. If you were using this to model some sort of classical processing situation, then I guess the this would be classical bits as with this, and so there's sort of an issue there. But really, this I sort of the picture I have is that these outcomes are just the data corresponding to these are just taken away straight away, written down, and posted somewhere else. We don't care about any sort of structure as to how that stuff relates, how that stuff interacts.
So outcomes are classical information in a quantum context.
The outcomes are classical information. You write them down on a piece of paper and you immediately post them to somebody who keeps them. And there's no complicated business regarding how they interact.
So don't use outcomes to influence future knob settings, for example?
So I think if you want to do that kind of thing, then it's better to also have a wire that has a classical thing going along it. And do it that way. That's not so important here. But when you get to a sort of situation having quantum gravity, where you imagine that the causal structure is not definite, then you don't actually know that it's possible to take a piece of data from one place to another or not. That's not so important. So it's better to physicalize that kind of process. So I think of this as sort of physical side of things, and this is the data side of things. And anything like that is part of the physical experiment. Okay, so we're going to imagine that we're dealing with closable sets of operations for the moment. So here's one example of a concept that you can set up with this framework. Now we've introduced probabilities. We can think of a preparation as being something like this, which is closed so far as inputs are concerned, but has a synchronous set of outputs. And then we can consider various portions of circuit that close this coming from the top. Now we call those measurements. So associated with each of these will be some probability, because this circuit has a probability, this one inside. So associated with this preparation, we can think of many different possible circuits. This is going over all possible circuits and list the probabilities. And then we'll say the state associated with preparation is that thing represented by any mathematical object that can be used to calculate the probability for any circuit with that preparation. So here's a list of all these probabilities. Alpha is labeling all the different measurements that I've put into place. And we can use a notion of linear compression. So we can say, well, it may be the case that the probabilities in this list are not all independent of one another. And in particular, you may be able to calculate some of them by linear relations of the others. So what I'm going to do is form a shorter list, which is just long enough that from the shorter list, I can calculate all the probabilities in the longer list using linear equations. So here's the linear equation. So a few things have happened. We've now got a shorter list of probabilities. In quantum theory, this list is of length n squared, where n is the dimension of the Hilbert space. So this is a set of, you might call these the fiducial measurements. This set K is a list of the fiducial measurements that you use to characterize a state. Oh, incidentally, we want this to be so that it works for any preparation. So that for any preparation, there exists this set of dual space vectors that can be used to calculate the probabilities. And now P is associated with the preparation. So P here represents the state. And this R vector is associated with the measurement. And you can compare this to the situation in quantum theory, where you have this kind of linear expression. In fact, in the case of quantum theory, there's a direct mapping between these objects, linear map. I call this linear compression. The reason it makes sense to use linear compression in the case of probabilities is that generally you can form mixtures, and you can show that at least if you're allowed to form arbitrary mixtures, then linear compression is actually optimal. So you can see we have this kind of structure. We had an operational structure where we talked about these operations and how they can be put together to form circuits. And then on top of that, by introducing probability through this notion of having closed a set of operations, we can start to introduce concepts of probability theory. And we can use this to prove theorems. So here's an example of the sort of theorem that one might try to prove. There's two notions of purity of states. One notion is the more usual notion of extremal states. So if you have a convex set of states, the extremal states in that convex set can be defined as pure. Another notion of purity is states which are such that if a system is in that state, there doesn't exist any state of a composite system where there's correlation. So those would be uncorrelatable states. In quantum theory, extremal states and uncorrelatable states are the same thing. It looks like you can prove that that's true in general in this probabilistic in this sort of probabilistic theories. Uncorrelatable states are states where this is just on the side, incidentally. Uncorrelatable states are states where if the system is in an uncorrelatable state, then there doesn't exist any composite system where the reduced state is that uncorrelated state for system A, say, and where there's correlation between the two systems. In other words, the probabilities have to factorize if one of the systems is in an uncorrelatable state. It seems to be a very natural definition, a very, very natural notion of purity. You know, think something is pure and it can't be correlated with something else. And in some senses, it's actually more natural, I think, than the extremal
the extremal definition of purity, because the extremal definition of purity implies that you have the ability to form mixtures, and that's maybe a less not such a simple notion. So I think I've proven this. I need to sort of go through and sort of dot the I's and cross the T's in this proof, but I think we can do that. You can definitely prove it this direction. Often when you don't, it seems that when you don't have this sort of more general operational structure I've talked about here, then to prove this kind of thing, you'd have to introduce some innocent-looking additional assumptions. So I think this is a much more natural setting where you try to be serious about the operational structure for proving those kinds of things. Otherwise, you have to sort of worry about what you mean by the same time or different times and so on. Okay, so I'm not going to go into this, but this framework, you can use this framework to support the definitions that are necessary for this set of axioms I have for deriving quantitatives. This is a set of axioms. This is a whole talk in itself that you can use to derive quantitative, I think they're relatively simple axioms. The framework I just gave you is a good foundation for setting up the concepts that go into these topics. Okay, so the operational structure that I just described to you is according to Bob Kirker. And I say that because I don't really know anything about category theory. So according to Bob Kirker, this is a symmetric monoidal category. So it may be that the category theory is a way of formalizing operational structures. So you can imagine that you have now category theory as a sort of foundational basis, and on top of that lives something like the convex cones approach as a sort of structure for building up the ingredients that go into physical theories. However, this operational structure I just talked about does have a background time. In quantum gravity, we're going to expect to see some sort of indefinite causal structure. So background time is going to be a problem if you have to have background time in your framework. So it seems to me that the sort of structure we just discussed won't do. So here's a way to think about that. So in these symmetric monoidal categories, you have a tensor and a composition. The tensor is more or less a kind of space-like separation between operations. Or strictly speaking, it's a no signaling separation. And the composition reinforces a kind of time-like separation between operations. So this enforces a definite causal structure using these two notions. And that seems to me to be problematic if you want to go to quantum gravity where you don't want to be forced to have definite causal structure. So what I'm going to do in the remaining bit is talk about the sort of preliminary results I have in the direction of building an operational structure that may be richer than this, and rich enough in particular, I hope, to accommodate in the long run some theory of quantum gravity. I don't know whether the structures I'm going to present are categories or not. They look like they might be. You can tell me. So I'm going to present what I'm calling object-oriented operationalism. And this is the beta version. It has all sorts of glitches in it, but it'll be worked out in time. What we want is an abstract categorization of operational structures, which is rich enough to describe all the salient aspects of an experiment. So the structure that I just talked about previously isn't such a structure. What that really does is it tells you about one particular type of way in which experimental apparatuses can talk to each other. In particular, it captures the notion of the connection between two operations due to a system passing through. What that means in operational terms is it captures the notion of having these operations aligned, so they have apertures in them which are aligned, like lasers, the aperture to the laser is aligned with the aperture to the lens and so on. And then also, there are some sorts of timing considerations. So this is really the kind of restricted operational situation that I've considered so far, and that people generally consider in the literature on this sort of convex frameworks and so on. So that's not good enough. So I want to work on something rich enough, I hope, ultimately to accommodate quantum gravity and certainly to accommodate general relativity.
So I want to introduce two different concepts one can distinguish concerning the relationships between apparatuses. Here's one idea, the idea of a connection. So a connection, for example, is, well, this plug is plugged into here. That's connected. It's the kind of thing you don't expect your theory to make predictions about, but rather you take it as a given. So you say, well, given certain connections, what can I say? So another example of connections is the alignment of apertures. You don't expect your physical theory to tell you what particular apertures you end up aligning, what the probabilities are for that. Rather, you say, given a certain alignment of apertures, what can I say about the probabilities of other things? So that's one notion. Another notion is coincidences. So these are things that a theory can make predictions about, but that one can also condition on a coincidence. So an example of a coincidence would be the coincidence between marks on some rulers, for example. So you expect a theory to make predictions of this sort, predictions of the probability of some set of coincidences given some set of connections, or maybe even the probability of some set of coincidences given some other set of coincidences and some set of connections. So now I'm going to give a new notion of what I mean by an object. So here's an object. So an object now has on this side various nodes that I call connectors, because they're going to form the things that make connections. And on the other side, it has various nodes that I call coinciders. I think at least this word I invented myself. Google doesn't need to point to that. Then also we have some knob settings, which rather than representing by knobs on the object, I've got them as an arrow coming in. And then we have some outcomes. Incidentally, one thing I didn't say before that I think is relevant, really what an object is it's one use of an apparatus. So when you draw a circuit, you may use the same object, you may use the same apparatus many times. And if you do that, each use of the apparatus will appear as a separate box in your circuit. So this is an object. And then we can form composite objects. So here's a composite object with just two operations. You can, of course, form them with many operations. And what we've done is we've connected up some of these connectors for this one, left some of them unconnected, and we've connected and we've coincided some of the coinciders and left some of them uncoincided. So now we have a new object. So note that in here, there's no direction of time implicit. These coinciders don't have to have any notion of direction of time implicit in them. They might, but they don't have to. So here's some examples just to illustrate the ideas. And these are perhaps a bit rough. One should probably be more sophisticated if you're going to do anything serious with this structure. So here's a set of rulers that are floating in space that may happen to coincide in certain points. And you can imagine that the rulers have a little meter that tells you the difference between the two coincidence points. So here's the output telling you the length difference. And then this gives you the different coincidences. Here's another example, a wheel, which is pivoted. And so now you have the wheel, you have here, this pivot is a kind of connection. You wouldn't expect the physical theory to make any predictions concerning the connection. And then here you have a mark on the wall, which can coincide with a mark on the wheel. And so you might imagine as the wheel rotates, you can do some experiment concerning the instance of these coincidences. And so here's a diagram representing this. We have the wheel, which is connected to this. And then we have the mark on the wall, which coincides with the mark on the wheel. Then also, because both of these things are attached to some background frame, we have some kind of connection between these as well. Sorry?
That picture represents one.
This is, well, in my language, this is the coincidence. Right. This is kind of one configuration.
It happens once.
Sorry?
It happens once.
Yeah, this is just, yeah. So we need to make this into an interesting experiment. You'd have to introduce a clock. Mm. And the clock would also be wired into this diagram. Maybe you'd have a clock here that's connected to that, and then you'd have something to measure. So this is not sufficiently interesting yet to constitute an experiment. So you may have more general notions of connection and coincidence. It doesn't have to be just a simple point thing. So here's another example, alignment by eye. So you may be sitting here on planet Earth and looking at two other planets, A and B. It's the Alice planet and the Bob planet. And you may happen to notice that they're aligned. Well, that's a kind of connection, and you could represent it by some diagram like this. Here's another example. So I don't know the physics behind this. Let's imagine we have two detectors that measure the coincidence of each measured coincidence of two particles. So this detector flashes when these two particles coincide with each other, as does this one. So that defines two separate events. But in the theory of quantum gravity, the interval between those two events may not be something which is well-defined. There may not be a well-defined space-time interval. But you might still imagine that there are measurements that you can make that give something analogous to, eigenvalues corresponding to a fuzzy measurement of space-time. Okay. So I don't know what that would look like. I have no idea how to construct that apparatus. But you could imagine doing such an experiment, which would have outcomes telling you, it would be something analogous to performing a spin measurement along a diagonal direction rather than along the up, down, left, right direction. So this would be the diagram for that sort of experiment. Here's another example. This is a ticking clock. This clock is ticking 1 second at a time. And then here we have, the connections are that it's the same clock. And then the coincidences are that there's 1 second difference each time. You see an example where you have many operations corresponding to the same object. Sorry, to the same apparatus. You buy it from Swatch. Or this one. We can say an operation is closed if it has no open connectors or coinciders. And we can say an operation can be closed if there exists another operation which can form a closed composite operation with A. So you can wire it up in such a way that the composite operation is closed. So now I want to introduce probabilities. And this is what I'm calling causaloid 2.0, so beta version. So for those of you who are aware of my previous work on the causaloid framework, this is now sort of trying to do it in a more sophisticated way in the context of this object-oriented operationalism. So we say a set of operations is closable if all operations can be closed. So you can always find another operation that you can wire up, so there are no open outputs, no open wires. All closed operations have a well-defined probability, i.e. independent of disconnected stuff going on. I don't know, these may not be the best two assumptions you can use to promote such a framework, but as a sort of as a working start, this seems to be useful. So now we consider only closable sets of operations in this sense. And we can define a notion of holds. So here we have some operation. This may be quite a big thing. Who knows? It may involve most of the universe, all of the universe. And then we have over here a set of wires that come from connectors and coinciders in which we can insert different possible operations. So let's consider all the different operations we could insert in here, label them with alpha. Then if you look at the combined object, the combined operation, rather. Sorry, I keep confusing the word object and operation. The combined operation. Then we can write down a list of all the probabilities. And we can say that, in some sense, is associated with this, which we can call a preparation. I put inverted commas around the word preparation because there's no sense of time direction here. And then we can do the same thing I did before, where you linearly compress this into a shorter set of probabilities such that there exists this sort of linear expansion. And then what you have is associated with each operation that you could put in this hole, you have a vector R sub alpha. So vectors are associated with operations. And what's interesting is that if you understand the mathematics of these vectors, then essentially you have all that you need to do useful predictive work. So here's one thing you might try and do. You might try and form the causal load product. So let's imagine we have two operations that may have been placed in hold. And now we want to regard these two operations as constituting a single operation. We want to find the R vector associated with that single operation. Well, this is it. It's R sub alpha 1, alpha 2. We have some given set of coincidence and connections between these two operations. And we imagine that there is some product, which I call the causal load product, that looks like this. And you can show that this causal load product takes this form. It's kind of bilinear product between the components of these two vectors, where this matrix depends on the particular way in which the two operations are linked together. If there are no links here, then this becomes the identity, and this causal load product is just the tensor product. So I don't have time to go into all the machinery of the causal load framework, but what you can do is you can use these R vectors to calculate whether a particular probability concerning any particular part of any particular operation is well defined. And then if the probability is well defined, you can use it to calculate the value of probability. And you can do this without reference to a background time. So let me conclude. So what I've been trying to say is, well, operational structures provide a foundation for general probabilistic theories. We can give an operational structure which is sufficient for quantum theory. And this is the thing which is equivalent to a symmetric Minoian category, and it has a background time. We can try to do a bit better than that if we're interested in quantum gravity ultimately. And I've set up at least the beta version of this thing I call object-oriented operationalism. But then we can add probabilities to this. So just in the same way that previously we had an operational structure and probabilities put on top, now again we have object-oriented operationalism as the foundational operational structure on which we can put probabilities in the form of this causal load 2.0 framework. So it adds probabilistic flesh to these structural bones. In particular, if we can apply this ultimately to general relativity and then quantum gravity, we have a way of injecting the measurement problem into general relativity so that we can get a Copenhagen interpretation of general relativity. and then finally you can make some progress. Okay, thank you.
So it wasn't really obvious what you said, even though you wanted to understand coincidence and connections differently, whether there was actually any mathematical distinction between these things.
No, I think you're right. The one doesn't have to distinguish mathematically. Conceptually, I think it's clear, clean to make a distinction. Mathematically, you could, I think mathematically, you could treat the coincidence as a certain type of connection. I don't want to do that because I'm trying to add conceptual flesh to this framework, and I feel that having this distinction is very useful at this stage. When you're in the process of constructing a theory, it's you're trying to find the best framework, best mathematical framework for making progress, even if that's not the only thing. So you have composition.
Yeah, if you're pointing a force to them, you can look that out.
Yeah, I'd like to see the details.
Our next speaker is Peter Sellinger.